questions.
Okay. Well, this is take three. Lucy says, "Dear Mistletoe and Wine, with an H, I listened with interest to your item last week about music from Pride and Prejudice appearing in Napoleon."
Yes. Have we done this already?
We did reference it in take two. Okay. "I experienced a variation on this earlier this year when I was ambushed by the Ellie Goulding song Still Falling for You, playing in the trailer for the Lily James movie What's Love Got to Do With It?
Oh, right, yeah, trailer movies.
As I was at the time trying to get over a relationship of over 30 years, for which Still Falling for You had become a key hour tune,
right,
I did my British best to sob only mildly uncontrollably and made a mental note never to see this particular Lily James movie ever. But you know what it's like when you pick at a scab a month or so later and resolving to face my demons. Once and for all, I bought a ticket for What's Love Got to Do With It? And at every critical beat of the plot, I braced myself for what was surely coming. But bizarrely, the Ellie Goulding track does not appear anywhere in the film, not even at the end during the credits. I was so frustrated to have built up this particular Rubicon that by the end, I was actually desperate to hear the song that I'd previously been dreading." Which is kind of a positive result, isn't it?
Yes.
"Why would they use a song for a trailer that doesn't feature in the film? And does this happen a lot? And perhaps most importantly, are there any other movies featuring Still Falling for You that I should avoid in future? Down with all the usual suspects, but compassion for Christmas Grinches," says Lucy. So, aren't trailers made by completely different people?
Yeah, there's the example of this that I can think of is that there was a trailer for a long time for the Hughes Brothers film Menace to Society, and it's a brilliant trailer, and it plays out to Marvin Gaye's What's Going On, which isn't in the film. And so trailers are indeed farmed out to trailer companies, and quite often, I mean, like last week we played a trailer clip, from Please Don't Destroy Treasure of Foggy Mountain. And that had a joke in it that isn't in the film because the trailer was made from an earlier cut of the film before it got, you know, finished and tied up. And that quite often happens. So there will be scenes in trailers that aren't in films. There are cases in which there are even characters in films, in trailers that aren't in films. But the music, it's more common than you would think. And the most common thing is that the trailer will play out to a piece of incidental music from another film, which is simply sub-licensed.
There you go. So that's sort of an explainer.
Yeah.
Also, the Rubicon, from the Latin for red, because it is a red shallow river.
Oh, is that why the Rubicon is called the Rubicon?
Apparently, from iron deposits.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Which Julius Caesar crossed.
He did cross the Rubicon, yes.
Fat lot of good it did him.
Crossing the Delaware. I mean, it's like, you know.
What did Delaware?
Is that a song lyric?
What did Delaware? Harry Como or someone like that. I introduced him on Top of the Pops, but I probably called him Frank Sinatra. Right. Mark Whitehouse.
Probably called him Modern English.
In Bristol. "Dear Suburban Kids with Biblical Names, Vanguard East, a first-time emailer and heritage listener since 2015. Yes, it's taken me that amount of time to come up with a question I deem worthy of your esteemed attention. So here goes. Does Simon..." This is a very strange question. "Does Simon consciously choose to wear John Lennon-style glasses because a bolder style, similar to Mark's, would draw double-act comparisons with the two Ronnies? To which the answer is no. I feel that a more distinct frame would suit Simon and hate to think of him having made some kind of sartorial sacrifice just because Mark got there in the first place with a more angular look. I myself am a fellow glasses wearer with similarly unhatogenic head and..."
Unwhat?
Unhatogenic, which I think is a made-up word for not suitable for a hat.
Well, you don't like people wearing hats anyway.
Not indoors.
I agree with that.
Even if you're Napoleon.
Yeah.
"And I found that rather than choosing frames for their relative invisibility, I've embraced the bold angular look and people now say I look better bespectacled than not."
Bespectacled?
No.
Bespectacled.
So I would say the answer to that is no. Everyone chooses a glasses based on the shape of their head. And I have worn stronger, in inverted commas, glasses. But the one that is most appropriate are the ones that I wear.
Yeah.
Trust me, I've tried loads. So I just find that the smaller ones are just better for my head.
You've always worn those since I've known you, haven't you?
Yes, I have worn slightly stronger frames suggested by the good lady ceramicist.
Oh, and they really? Were,
it was an incorrect suggestion.
Was it?
Yes.
How did it go down when you said, "I don't like them"?
No, I did wear them for a while. And then I thought, no, I'm going to go back to wearing the still referred to as the John Lennon glasses, which were kind of the NHS glasses. That's what they basically were.
Yeah, although those aren't NHS glasses. Those are super expensive.
They're expensive to get that cheap NHS look that John Lennon had. But anyway, I mean, thank you, but no.
Could I tell you just briefly to throw this in. So my glasses life was made much better when I was in Portreath and my neighbour was an optician. Well, he's an optician, Mark Alexander, and he said, "Oh, you must come into the shop, you know, and have a look." Because I had a pair of glasses that I needed fixing, and he came round with some sort of magical, you know, pliers and did stuff, and it made it all work. And then he said, "Oh, you must come into the optician, which is Alexander Miller in Falmouth, and walk the full length of the counter." And I went into this, opticians, and it was like, oh my word, I've suddenly discovered that I'm meant to wear big frame glasses. And I have never felt happier than, because when I first had glasses, you won't remember this.
You were Nick Lowe.
No, but when I first had glasses, I had glasses not unlike, you know, I had the ones that were just like...
Small ones, yeah.
Yeah, but even with no frame, you know, because I had worn glasses before, and so I wanted glasses that looked like I wasn't wearing glasses, that you wouldn't notice. Because I think, for example, if you had to say, what does Simon Mayo look like? The first thing you would say would not be, he wears glasses. You'd say, you know, he's this tall, he's got this coloured hair, strawberry blonde.
Always.
Oh, and he wears glasses. But whereas with me, I think because I wear and I've got now 9 pairs of glasses, all from Alexander Miller, which I love, and I absolutely love changing my glasses in the morning. You know, I've got to, I have them on the counter.
You change your glasses, so you wake up with one pair on and you change them?
No, I mean, okay, I'll wear one pair one day and I'll wear another pair the next day. And, you know, and I make a sort of decision on what kind of mood I'm in.
And what do your glasses today indicate?
These are my working glasses. These are the glasses that I wear for this show.
Oh, okay.
Although sometimes I wear the sort of Cronenberg-y, the see-through ones, you know. But generally, these are the glasses that I wear for this show. The ones that are on the poster are the ones that I used to wear for this show.
Pete Roberts, a short email. I have a question I don't think you've been asked before. Which era of film would you have liked to have been born into? For example, the first talkies, or the first colour film, or even the first CGI, though that might have been too recently.
Honestly, I mean, although obviously the time itself wouldn't have been, may not have been a great time to be alive, I would have loved to have been there at the birth of cinema. When silent films, when shorts, and the idea of going to see a film was still utterly miraculous, and people were completely like astonished by. I mean, I know there's all the stories about, a train coming into the station, playing at the cafe in Paris, and people running away, and I know that's all apocryphal, but if you think about when cinema first emerged out of the fairgrounds and out of the kind of phantasmagoria projections, there's a brilliant, brilliant, brilliant Bill Douglas Cinema Museum in Exeter, which they've got all these very, very early forms of moving image projection. And I would love to have seen what it was actually like to see moving images projected for the first time.
You'd have been completely blown away by it.
Yeah, I know. I mean, just imagine.
It's actually moving.
Yeah, it's a picture and it's moving and it's like watching a dream on screen. And then, of course, very, very quickly that turns into, you know, slapstick shorts, but also all those, you know, the early Méliès films, the weird experimentalism of, look, we can make moving images and we can edit film and we can run things backwards. And yeah, no, I would, that would be the time for me. What about you?
Well, I think similarly, actually, and I was just thinking, I just checked the date. So the Titanic sank in 1912. The first movie about the sink of the Titanic.
It's the same year, isn't it?
The same year, either 1912 or 1913.
That's right, yeah.
Incredible.
I know,
but imagine how now we kind of expect that kind of thing to happen. I mean, that was remarkably soon.
But isn't the unsinkable Molly Brown in that first Titanic film?
I honestly can't remember, but I think you're right. Nothing would have beaten the first time that you saw pictures move. It would have been a bit like hearing rock and roll for the first time on the radio.
Yeah.
That I think there's still new stuff that we get excited about. But when you hear people like Paul Simon talking about hearing rock and roll for the first time, you think, oh, was there anything, have we had anything similar? Was it punk? well, no, not really. You know, hearing Donna Summer, Do I Feel Love, that was amazing. But that first time you heard Crackly Radio playing some rock and roll, I suspect that was more thrilling. That's just a guess.
No, exactly. And that's, and that takes us back again to things like when, you know, Blackboard Jungle opened in cinema. And these stories are true, that when Blackboard Jungle first opened, because it begins with Rock Around the Clock, and people would go nuts and they'd dance in the aisle and, you know, tear up the cinema seats and all that stuff. And everyone said, well, no, did that actually happen? Well, it did. And probably the reason it did was because, for a start, Rock Around the Clock, even though Bill Haley was 105 when he recorded it, that one, two, three, you know, if you hear that in a big cinema projection, I mean, even back then when they had crappy little mono systems, it was still in a big room, and it must have been absolutely thrilling.
Chris, on this question, chaps, what's the greatest insult you've ever heard in a film or television show? For me, it's in The Social Network and the dryly acidic way that Jesse Eisenberg as Mark Zuckerberg refers to the Winklevoss twins as Winkelei, thereby turning them into something unpleasant and weird that he's looking at through a microscope. I mean, wow. The first thing that I thought of, bizarrely, I think, but though I still think it's a movie that, I mean, it's dated badly, but War Games. Also Matthew Broderick, I think, who's already had a bad mention for his Godzilla film. But the line is, and I check this, or is it, so he's talking to Professor Falcon, who they've been trying to find all the way through the film. Maybe you could tell us who first suggested the idea of reproduction without sex. Matthew Broderick says, your wife. Which, I mean, but there are so many fantastic. An email from Chasha Malijani in Lusaka, Zambia. I got wiser after hearing how my fellow followers write to you guys and noticed a brief resume. Oh, yeah, okay, fine, never mind about that. So anyway, he loves the show. So thank you. Thank you, Chasha. I'm curious to see if you have a list of favourite post-apocalyptic monster movies, if any, or maybe just your general thoughts on the few that you have seen and look forward to seeing. So basically, it's a question about your favourite post-apocalyptic movies. So
post-apocalyptic monster movies or...
Slash monsters. So,
oh, I see, fine.
So it can have monsters in. So I would go for... Well, this year, The Creator, I thought was very good. Day After Tomorrow, I think
that counts. Does The Creator count as post-apocalyptic?
Well, yes, because there's a very bad thing that's happened.
Oh, there is a bad thing. Is it
which the AI is blamed for. Which
That's right. No, okay, no, that's fine. Yeah, okay.
The Day After Tomorrow, I still think is fun.
Yeah, that's one of Joanna Hogg's favourite films.
Is that right?
She loves disaster movies. I asked her why. She said, I love seeing absolute spectacular disaster on screen because it makes all my own problems seem so small.
Good point. And Terminator probably counts, doesn't it? Because in the future...
In the future, the bad thing has happened.
So it's a pre-apocalyptic.
Yeah, that's interesting. So I will... Well, I would say The Last of Us. I know it's not a movie.
No, good.
It's a series, but I think that was it was an absolute game changer. I am fond of the film of The Road. I think it's, you know, I know
really?
I do think it's, you know, it's an interesting movie, and I think it was treated badly by people who would just cross with it for not being the book, and you know. It's an unfilmable book, probably, and I thought they did a sort of, you know, a fairly decent job of it. I'm going to stick with The Last of Us for the moment. I know it's not because of me, I didn't watch television for a long time, but I did think The Last of Us was really affecting. When's the new series coming?
Oh, I think it's going to be quite a long time because I think they're only filming now.
Right.
Because of strikes, etc. So my guess is it's going to be 2025, probably. Seems a long time to wait.
Okay. Yeah, so that, I do think The Last of Us is it's really, really stayed with me, and then we talked about it quite a lot, and it was remarkable.
That and Succession are the TV highlights of the year, certainly.
Yeah,
the best series.
I agree.
Sonia says, very long term listener, fully paid up member of the Vanguardista. Blah, 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 blah. My son and his girlfriend, now fiance, Brett and Jen, have been working in Australia for the last 15 months and are coming home on Saturday, and we can't wait. Love Actually is our favourite family Christmas film, and we are looking forward to having a Love Actually style reunion at the airport together with his sister Sian, who is 4 months pregnant and getting married on the 30th of December. Themed Disney characters, if you're interested. My question is, have you, by design or accident, recreated a film moment? So, I mean, this is this is sort of waiting to be filmed by Richard Curtis, isn't it? And I think a few years ago, we all went ice skating on Christmas Eve at Somerset House. And whilst we were going round, or in my case, holding on to the perimeter fence, a guy got down on one knee in the middle of the ice rink and proposed. And he clearly thought it was a Richard Curtis movie. And it did feel and look like a Richard Curtis movie. But that whole airport reunion thing we're doing this Christmas, and we did last Christmas, because Denmark family fly in on Christmas morning. So we're at Heathrow Airport on Christmas morning wearing Santa hats and holding up a sign saying Happy Christmas in Danish, you know. So
what is Happy Christmas in Danish?
I can't remember. I wrote it out last year. Don't ask me to remember. Maz Magelson, I think. is definitely what I'm going to say. If I held up a poster that said Maz Magelson, and he would think I'm his taxi driver. Then he arrives thinking this could be very, very confusing. So have you ever been in a moment where it either by design or accident, which felt like you were in a movie?
Well, it won't surprise you to know that by design, I have, that when the good lady Professor Harry Dawes and I got married and we went on honeymoon to America, and part of the honeymoon involved going to Georgetown so that she could take my photograph in all the places in Georgetown, reproducing scenes from The Exorcist. And one of the things that she did that I was most, most proud of is we went to the house, you know, and we went to the steps, and we went to to Georgetown University. And I had with me a collection of stills so that I could line the shots up so that I could literally stand in the place. Anyway, there is a still, quite a famous still, of it's on the Georgetown campus, of Lee J. Cobb and Jason Miller walking along in conversation with each other, okay? And this is how mad it was. I got Linda to take a photograph, one photograph of me being Lee J. Cobb, and then another photograph of me being Jason Miller. And then in the days before Photoshop, because that's how long ago we got married, we got home, and when the pictures were produced, we cut it in half and glued them together so that there is a picture of me talking to myself walking across the Georgetown campus.
Okay, so the answer to that is yes. Yes, very much so. An email from Deepika, redhead feminist, second prize, 11th grade Rotary Club debate tournament. Long-term listener, multiple-time emergency mailer, vanguardist, colonial commoner, currently living in Canada. Your repeated advertising having had the desired effect. I read Itch and Itch Rocks. I know it didn't say Itchcraft, which is the third book. First of all, these
are... We're playing the Dodge Brothers single, are we?
First of all, these are genuinely gripping fun books, especially for chemistry nerds, of whom I am one. But I notice a trend that I'd love to get your take on. Growing up, my YA reading consisted of the Nancy Drew and Hardy Boys series, where the violence was limited to characters punching each other, being shot at, and perhaps... I have to say... But this is still... That's pretty in your face, isn't it? And perhaps being knocked out and locked up by a goon. Given the much higher peril and descriptions of violence in your books, how do you decide how to write about violence?
Okay, that's an interesting question.
Are there age-related guidelines, as in cinema? How much have books like The Hunger Games shifted narrative expectations of violence in YAs? And a final question, does the increased violence in movies and TV series then also influence writers to write more violence into thrillers and so on? I guess I'm asking, what do you think is the overall cultural impact of watching more violence?
Yeah. Well, you go first, because this is a literary question about writing about it.
Yes. I mean, I should say I've written three kids, so there were three Itch books, so I've just done three. Then I wrote one YA book, which was Blame, and now I've been writing adult books. As I've said before, the only thing...
books.
Well, you know, not like erotic silliness.
But Simon Mayo is the author of adult books.
Adult books. Grown-up books.
Author of Dotty Gets Spanked. And
that's actually... How did you know that's good? I'm working towards... I mean, it is certainly true, as I think I've said before, that the only thing that makes a YA book a YA book is that it has a teenage protagonist.
Yeah.
The levels of drugs, sex, violence... and the things that give it higher ratings, you know, is exactly the same.
Right. Probably,
or you can certainly have that content in a YA book.
Right. Yeah.
So, but the issue is, I think, for children's books. So I think the answer to your question is, I think Hunger Games has shifted the narrative, because when you look at what happens in Hunger Games with children killing children,
the cornucopia thing,
then that has, I think that did shift the narrative. So when I wrote Blame, it wasn't anywhere near as violent, though it is pretty grim. And I think I think the answer is it all boils down to the relationship between the writer and the editor. And you write what you want to write, knowing who you're writing for. And the kids' books were written for top end primary, first year, first and second year secondary. So you write with that in mind. So you write instinctively, I think. And then if you get it wrong, your editor says, this was too much, and it comes out, you know. So there aren't a set of rules. You just instinctively know if it's wrong. You know, you won't have a kid's book where the kid has got a gun who shoots people. That won't happen. In a YA book, it can do and has done. So that's why it's helpful when you go into a bookshop and, you know, and they're categorized, you know, for, you know, infant mm-hmm. books and 3 to 6. And because it is, because there are kind of unwritten rules, and an editor would be a better placed person to say, if I see this, I instinctively know that it's wrong. But YA has, you know, if you've read any Melville Burgess, you know that, you know, it's full on. It's just, it has a teenage protagonist. So I don't think there are any written rules. It's an instinctive thing between the writer and the editor. And I think Hunger Games did shift it. But do you think, the last question, that when you see violence in movies and television series, that someone who's writing will think, okay, well, I can do that? Because I think instinctively that would be the case, wouldn't it? You know, so that
you're the writer. You tell me. Has it happened? Has your writing style been affected by what you've seen in cinema?
I suspect inevitably it has been, not consciously, but if you watch a very influential, like, for example, there's a similar conversation going on about swearing. So the amount of swearing on television this year has been more than in any. You watch Succession. It's just, it's very commonplace. And it didn't used to be commonplace. And streaming has had an impact on that. So I suspect that if you are writing a TV drama, you might put a lot more swearing in because you've seen Succession. It would just be a natural reaction, wouldn't it? I don't know.
Yes. I mean, language is probably the area in which it is the most acute, because it's, you know, it is absolutely quantifiable. You know, how many, there was my friend Matt O'Casey made a documentary called 50 Years of F, which was, you know, from the broadcasting of the first F word on the BBC. It is probably true. And this is the thing that the BBFC say, that most of their time is taken up. It's not to do with violence. It's not to do with nudity. And most of their time is taken up trying to figure out exactly how much profanity may or may not be acceptable. And when we were talking earlier on about film, and you were saying, oh, the certificate thing is because of language. So it's language and drug use, and simply referring to those things. As far as the violence thing is concerned, the only comparison I can make is that during the Video Nasties era, there was a writer called, well, there was a bunch of writers, but there was one particular writer called Sean Hudson. And Sean Hudson became known as King of the Nasties. And so you'd have, on the one hand, you'd have Clive Barker, who was, like, you know, I suppose, fairly kind of highbrow. I mean, his stuff was quite extreme and graphic, but it was fairly highbrow. And then James Herbert, who had started out doing things like The Rats, in which they'd be quite gory descriptions of people being eaten alive by rats. And then you had Sean Hudson, and also, you know, Guy N. Smith, and what's that thing? There's that book, which I've said before, The Sucking Pit, which Stephen King described as one of the very few books whose title rhymes with your opinion of it. But Sean Hudson's description of himself is very, very Stephen King. Sean Hudson's description of himself as King of the Nasties, that was a label that definitely came from Video Nasties. And he was very influenced by, I hope I'm representing him correctly, he was very influenced by heavy metal, and he liked, you know, he had a particular taste in music and a particular, and he would very specifically write nasty gore in the way of the kind of extremities of the video. And I think that was definitely, the two things were hand in hand. You know, if you were watching Zombie Flesh Eaters or something, and then a Sean Hudson book would be the perfect accompaniment to it. That's the only one I can think of in which I can very specifically think that a writer was influenced by what was absolute. And so if it happened with Sean, it must have happened with other people.
Tim says, Mark wanted to know, wanted his computer to stop showing memories.
Yes.
If this is a Mac, as I think
it's
it is,
not.
He needs to go to settings in Photos and untick show memories notification. If it's an iPhone, does your phone do it?
No.
Then go to settings, photos, and switch off featured content. And he's even sent in a thing.
Okay, but it's not. I've got, well, this is a Dell. It's a PC.
Oh, well, there's no hope for you then.
So would that not work?
It'll be a different set of things.
Okay, show holiday events. What on earth is that?
Anyway, well, you haven't got one. So what you need to do is to get a Mac, and then you know how to turn them off. You can keep that. Get a Mac for Christmas, and your life will be better.
Okay, reset suggested memories settings. It's in photos. Well, I'll try.
Finally, what do we got here? Yes. Christopher, my kids are now old enough, they're 11 and 13,
yeah,
that I can start watching the classic adventure films of my youth, Galaxy Quest, Fistful of Dollars, Indiana Jones. But the other day, I wanted something more challenging. So I took to the internet and I got the usual list of, quote, family films. Many of them great, like the Paddingtons, E.T.'s, Toy Stories, which we've already seen. But I couldn't find a list of non-childish family films.
Non-childish family films.
Yes. So this is going to be in the eye of the beholder, isn't it, really?
Yeah.
As to whether it's childish. So, for example, Princess Bride. That seems to me like a non-childish family film.
Is there kissing in it?
Exactly. Even though there is that fantastic sequence with Peter Falk and his son. Grandson reading the story. So it starts off with the premise of being a child being read a book.
Yeah.
But I don't think it's childish. In fact, having rewatched it recently, there's a scene towards the end, which is a little, you know, where you think, oh, okay, you should have turned it. I don't think that really has transferred.
Is it a little French in nature?
Yes, and a little forceful and a little kind of, I think you should have backed off at this point. Enough. Is School of Rock.
School of Rock was a 15, I think.
But it is childish in as much as it's about children at school. But to me, it doesn't feel like a childish film.
Yeah, let me see if School of Rock. No, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe School of Rock was a 12.
I'd have thought so.
Let's just check. School of Rock is a 12A.
Okay,
so that's that's a perfect.
It's a non-child, but it's full of children.
Yeah, moderate bad language, discriminatory terms, rude humor, but 12A, School of Rock. Yeah, absolutely. Although, oh, look at that. Oh, no, that's a different thing. Yeah, no, 12.8, yeah, fine. I think that's a perfect example.
Look at that. What was that a reference to, as we couldn't see what you
because
were looking
at? Because the next thing down was Rock School, which is 15, and I just wondered whether it had
okay,
a
15
had
is...
No, that's fine. School of Rock, 2003.
So you agree it's non-childish, even though it's
yes, although it's absolutely with children, yes. I mean, I would say Time Bandits, which has a child hero, but I think is a film that you could watch at absolutely any age. You know, don't touch it, it's evil.
You see, I found myself also thinking of Parent Trap, the remake, the Lindsay Lohan version. Lindsay Lohan, beg your pardon. Because I watched it 1,000 times.
I haven't seen it in a long time. Does it hold up? Is it good?
I think so. I remember enjoying it. Maybe it was...
It's the one when she's trying to get her mum to marry somebody or her dad to...
Get back together.
Get back together again, that's right.
Get back together again, yeah.
How
about Hugo? The Martin Scorsese.
Oh, a young hero, but absolutely a film
but
that...
Again, childish is by implication derogatory, isn't it?
Well, I mean, yes, although
non-childish family films, he's trying to say more grown-up family films.
Well, I would say Hugo is a perfect example. You're on fire today with these. School of Rock is a perfect example. I do think Time Bandits is a great example because I think Time Bandits is one of those fantasy films that anybody could watch of any age. And also, if you've just seen Napoleon, then watch Time Bandits for the Napoleon scene because the Napoleon scenes in Time Bandits are absolutely brilliant.
One of my pieces of advice for people who do interviews of any kind is never say, and finally. So I said, and finally for that, but I'm just going to put one more in.
Can I just say also,
yes,
pretty much all the Studio Ghibli films are... absolutely acceptable for all audiences. And I think one of the things that Ghibli understood that Disney later on tried to adopt was you can deal with really complicated subject matter in a way that will not alienate children, but will still speak to adults. So if you look at even if you just do the classic Ghiblis, they're just all brilliant for all ages.
Finally, absolutely.
And finally.
Categorically, finally, Julian Evitz.
Okay.
I went to see Napoleon this week. I was underwhelmed. Aside from the impressive battle scenes, it's too long, tries to be too many films at once, and is less than the sum of its parts.
It's not nasty enough.
I thought the sex scene just after the wedding was memorable for being the least erotic sex scene I have ever seen in a film.
Excellent, and I think that's the point.
Yes, so I wondered if either of you or the wider congregation were aware of any other spectacularly unerotic bedroom scenes in other films. Julian says, for me, Napoleon just pips Emma Thompson and Jeff Goldblum in The Tall Guy in this regard. Thanks for a great and expertly produced show. So,
I mean, there are loads of
spectacular. I think it needs to be intentionally unerotic.
Well, can I say it's not out yet, but Poor Things has many.
That is true. Okay, well, I can bring some of those up with Emma Stone, who is going to be on the show very shortly.
Yeah, yeah. So that has plenty of scenes of human coupling, which are designed not to be in any way erotic at all.
Yes.
But this, you know, I think it's a fairly brave decision on the part of Ridley Scott to make a huge, big, lavish film at the centre of which is a weaselly, annoying guy whose great romance with Josephine is basically portrayed as like a pathetic little joke.
So if you have any questions for us, questions or schmestions, particularly for our next Christmas and New Year edition, I don't know what sort of Christmassy questions you might come up with, but anyway, Christmas and New Year questions for our next edition would be very welcome. Correspondence@cobanamo.com. Thank you. Take one and take two. We'll be with you on Friday.